You're listening to a special podcast edition of The Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston, and sitting beside me at the Station Cafe at Harpenden is Lionel Burney, cycling journalist for the Sunday Times and Cycle Sport magazine. Lionel, you've come off the back of 6 weeks solid reporting, but today we're going to go for a bike ride.
It's my first bike ride in 6 weeks, yes. I've done the Tour de France and the Olympics, so that's sort of back-to-back grand tours, really. And I'm about to embark on a grand tour of a very different kind.
And how did you get on in the Tour and the Olympics? How was your general classification result? Was it what you were after?
I didn't win this year, but it was a good tour, obviously, with Bradley Wiggins winning. There was an awful lot of work to do. Interest in cycling from, you know, areas of the media that I hadn't really expected, then that's really carried on with the Olympics. So it's been absolutely non-stop, and you know, cycling is on front pages of even the sort of middle market and tabloid newspapers, which is something that I didn't really think we'd see, and certainly not to this extent.
Well, we're going to go for a spin around your neck of the woods. Do you want to just sketch out the route that we're going to take?
Well, we're going to get out of Harpenden as quickly as we can into the lanes, and then we're going to head over towards sort of Ivinghoe Beacon. And we'll ride over Ivinghoe Beacon and then head out into the flatter lanes of the Chilterns, avoiding all the hills. And then we'll sort of loop back round near Berkhamsted and Ashridge and then come back, and we'll finish up at The Hub, which is a cycling-specific cafe in Redbourne, run by a man called Simon Barnes, who used to run the Ploughman Craven cycling team.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds like a great ride. How many kilometres is that approximately, do you reckon?
I'm not sure. It's probably about 50, 55, something
okay,
like that.
That sounds good. And one of the things I think we're going to be talking about is the People's Grand Tour, which is an idea that you had a while ago now and has been gathering pace. And it's something that I'm very keen to encourage participation in via the bike show. People's Grand Tour is a way of cycling every day for 3 weeks, isn't it, or something like that?
Yeah, it's the professionals ride the Grand Tours, the Tour de France, the Giro d'Italia and the Vuelta in Spain. 3 weeks of racing. It's the toughest mainstream sporting event. But the idea of the People's Grand Tour is to challenge yourself to ride the bike as often as you can in a 3 week period, and there's a nice sort of symmetry to a 3 week Grand Tour. It's the ultimate test of the professionals, and it's a period of time that you can focus on. You can start, you get 7 or 8 days in and you start to feel a bit tired, but by the time you're at the halfway mark, you can already see the end. And it's not obligatory to ride every day, but the idea is to challenge yourself to get out on the bike as often as you can in a 3 week period, and see where you measure up against the hopefully couple of hundred other people who are taking part all around the country, all around the world, and maybe it will snowball into something magical.
Great. Well, we'll talk about how you can get involved while we're out on the road, but we ought to get moving.
We should. Fabulous view across the Chilterns from here. I've actually never pulled into here. I've always ridden up the hill or ridden down the hill. I suppose normally I would ride. The only place I would stop would be a cafe that's serving something with beans. So it's quite nice to actually stop. And I was just saying, you kind of take for granted the countryside that you cycle in all the time, and you don't realise actually it's quite nice here.
It's a stunning view. I mean, we're looking towards the Chilterns, or the Aylesbury 100, is that right? Or
there's a sportive called the Chiltern 100, which actually goes up this hill, and we're going down it. But yeah, it goes up to Whipsnaden, round, and then over Dunstable Downs, and then across, and then it goes across into more the west, I think it would be. So Wendover, and all around that way, Great Missenden, and then back and finishes somewhere around here. A good event. Loads of people were out doing it. It was in June this year, and I kind of tagged along with them for a bit. Cut out a couple of the steeper hills, but it was a lovely day.
And you displayed an impressive bit of cycling knowledge about the milk race, which passed through here in, when was it, Lyle?
I think that now you're putting me on the record. I think it was 91, the milk race came up this hill, and there was a King of the Mountains around the corner. I just remember Chris Lillywhite was in there, and I think probably Shane Sutton as well. And I'm not sure where the stage finished. It may have finished in Milton Keynes, perhaps. My memory is a little rusty on that, but I remember coming out to watch it. It must have been either half term or I took a day off school or something. I don't know, but it would have been a midweek, so maybe I bunked off in the afternoon. I've no idea.
Presumably that makes this hill a segment on Strava. Which we ought to talk a little bit about Strava, because Strava is one of the ways in which you can log your rides for the People's Grand Tour. But Strava is a bit of a cycling phenomenon, isn't it?
It is. It's really taken off, hasn't it, in the last, I suppose, the last year. This season, really, is when I've become aware of it. If you've got a GPS system or an iPhone and you download the Strava app, basically the world is split up into segments that people have logged, and then when your GPS system goes over that particular segment, it clocks your time and then sorts all of those times into a leaderboard. And yeah, Bison Hill is one, and I'm certainly not troubling the top places, that's for sure.
So the idea is you can race against yourself and better your own time, but you can also race against other people and see how you figure against everyone who rides that section of hill, using the internet as a way of, you know, logging everybody's ride and organising them into a leaderboard.
Yeah, I mean, when the Olympic road race was down in Surrey, a lot of the riders that have been, you know, they've set their benchmarks on Box Hill, their times would have been obliterated by the by any professional riders who had their GPS logging their Strava segments. I haven't actually looked to see what impact the road races have had on the Strava segments on Box Hill. I would just say, you know, great though Strava is, you know, people still have to exercise their own common sense and not get involved in, you know, racing, virtual racing on the roads, because, you know, there's traffic and everything, and there are some segments where, you know, start or finish on junctions, and I think everybody needs to just make sure that they stay safe first and worry about their Strava time second.
So there are prizes in the People's Grand Tour. There are leaderboards. Do you want to talk us through the various contests that you've got going in the People's Grand Tour that people will be competing for by submitting their distances and their rides?
The idea of the People's Grand Tour is to ride as often as you can. So there's 23 days in a 3-week period. It's not about how fast you go or how far you go per se, although there are categories for the people who spend the most time in the saddle and who cover the most distance in the 3 weeks. But really, the leaderboard is sorted by the number of days that you ride, and you need to ride on 10 days out of that 3-week period in order to qualify for the general classification. Last time I think we had two or three people who had a 100% record. I managed 22 days out of 23, which I was really pleased with, having only just scraped into my own leaderboard in the first event this year. So the idea is not really, it's not for people getting out and having to ride 100 miles every day, or, you know, having to go fast. It's about participation. Obviously, people are, you know, in their own little, you know, we've had clubmates who are racing against each other, trying to ride more often than their friends. And that's really what it's about. It's about trying to get people to make cycling a part of their everyday life, because there's, and again, I'm not entirely sure about the, you know, where this sort of notion comes from, but I remember reading something about how it takes roughly three weeks to form a habit. And I think after 3 weeks of cycling, I certainly feel a lot better. I feel a lot, you know, mentally better, physically better. And it had I not had to go off to the Tour de France for all of July, I certainly would have carried on cycling, you know, more regularly than perhaps I had been doing before, because it just forces you to incorporate cycling into your daily routine a lot more. And that really is what it's all about for me anyway, because I struggle working for myself, being at home, most of the time working in my own kind of bubble. It's so easy to put off cycling. I don't have to go out. So I just need that kind of external driver to make me cycle. And the People's Grand Tour is what helps me. So that's the idea.
Well, you are doing something to encourage participation in cycling, as are British Cycling and Team Sky, the amalgamation of these institutions that have had so much success with the Tour and then all these gold medals. Do you think, hand on heart, that Bradley Wiggins winning the Tour de France and all these gold medals on the track, do you think that is increasing participation in cycling in Britain?
I think it will do. I mean, I think cycling has already experienced an increase as a result of the Beijing Olympics and the success of Mark Cavendish. And it's certainly captured the imagination of a certain segment of society. You see a lot more people like me, I suppose, which is kind of time-crunched, middle-class sort of people who've gone out and bought a bike and they've got really into cycling. What I hope is that the boom in cycling embraces all areas of society and makes cycling respected as a mode of transport in urban areas, makes it respected as something that families can do together, mum, dad and the kids, makes it something that people from, you know, the cliche 7 to 70 and beyond, but makes it something that everybody can, whether you're riding down to the post box or the village or whether you're cutting across town to save yourself a bus fare or a train fare, or just riding along the canal towpath. I don't know whether that's allowed, is it? Canal towpath riding?
Yes, it is.
Is it? Right, that's good.
Well, there are a few places where it's a bit busy, where it's not encouraged, like around Paddington, but generally it is encouraged.
Perfect. So, yeah, I hope that, you know, I hope that people in general respect cycling a little bit more than perhaps they do. I think there's a mentality switch when people get behind the wheel of a car, perhaps, that you do experience. I mean, the day Bradley Wiggins won the time trial, we came back here and went out for an evening ride, and some Burke in a van tooted his horn and, you know, really sort of blasted his horn and drove past aggressively. And part of me wanted to give the benefit of the doubt and think that he was saying, well done, Bradley. But I'm not entirely sure that was the case. I think he was just in a hurry to get home or whatever. And I'd like to see just more respect for cyclists on the road. And the more people that are cycling, you know, will become more visible and will effectively, without being aggressive about it, but we will force motorists to factor cyclists in as legitimate road users.
Looking at the Olympics, we are in this British gold rush, and there's been a lot of focus on the television about, you know, how many medals we've got and counting the medals every 5 minutes. And a lot of that has come from the way in which sport has been funded at the elite level over the last few years, with a very clear medals target, and sports have been given funding if they've got a good chance of winning a medal. But a medal, I don't think, is an end in itself. Sport is there for things which are ultimately ends in themselves. Clearly there's entertainment, and I suppose watching somebody from your own country winning a medal gives you a certain patriotic buzz. But I would say that there are bigger things that we should be trying to be getting out of sport. Starting to tackle the obesity epidemic, mm-hmm. reducing the incidence of type 2 diabetes, heart disease, giving kids something that they can do that isn't, you know, antisocial or criminal behaviour, and just giving people something that they can do which isn't going down to the supermarket and spending lots of money. Shopping as leisure activity. Sport offers that opportunity for people to do things that is socially constructive and has a positive impact on their health and the state of our cities and towns, that we're not choked by petrol fumes and cars and all the rest of it. There's a critique which says focusing just on the medals means you put the money into the sports where we've got a bigger chance of winning a medal, not the sports which are going to do most to combat obesity and improve the nature of our society. Do you think that's a fair critique?
Well, I think that any success that can then breed the mentality switch that I was talking about. I'll give you an example. I spoke to Laura Trott's sister, Emma, for a piece I did in the paper at the weekend. And Emma's a professional cyclist as well, and she races for a team in Europe, in Holland. And I asked how her and her sister Laura got into cycling in the first place. And she said, basically, their mum was quite seriously overweight and needed to or wanted to lose weight. She'd been on diets before and hadn't stuck. And, you know, anyone who is overweight knows how hard that is to, you know, get onto that course of changing your lifestyle and seeing it through, not just in the short term, but in the longer term. And somebody suggested, why don't you try cycling? And they live in Hertfordshire, Cheshunt, I think it is. And they went cycling down by, I think, the canal or the river or wherever it was. And then they went down to Welling Track, and the two girls, Laura and Emma, who I think were about 9 and 11 at the time, got involved in the track racing down there and obviously showed an aptitude for it, became competitive, loved the kind of thrill of winning £1 or £2 in the track league races for kids. The family as a whole got into cycling. Their mum lost a lot of weight. Their dad had to give up cricket at the weekends in order to take the two girls down to the track. And then, you know, a decade later, Laura Trott is a double Olympic champion. And somebody posted a picture on Twitter last night of Bradley Wiggins from 2004, when Bradley Wiggins won the gold medal in the pursuit in Athens. And there's a picture of Bradley Wiggins and Laura Trott. And Laura Trott is wearing Bradley's gold medal. And to me,
she's about 12 years old.
So 8 years ago. So she was 12 years old. And those two kind of things overlapped. Mrs. Trott's desire to find an exercise that would help her lose weight, and the aspirational, inspirational aspect of a gold medalist. Those two worlds collided perfectly for Laura Trott. And now she's 20 years of age, double Olympic champion, and I can only assume, inspiring, you know, another generation of people. So I think that is what is so... But it is about the convergence of those two extremes.
But I would say that part of the logic of choosing the sports where we've got a bigger chance of winning medals is to choose sports that not many other countries are doing, sports that are quite difficult for other countries to do because they're expensive to do, they require a lot of investment, a lot of kit, a lot of infrastructure, because then we can, you know, make our money go further. Whereas if we decided to just compete in long distance running, well, there's anyone can compete in long distance running. All you need is you don't even need a pair of shoes. You can just run across the savannah in your bare feet and get pretty good conditioning. So we're choosing sports which are expensive to do because that's where we can have a competitive advantage as a rich nation. Now, what that does at a level of our society is essentially supports sports which are expensive to do at the level of our society. So only people who have a track nearby, who can afford to splash out on a bike, can afford to buy that horse for the dressage, can afford to get that sailing boat, or all the other sports that we do that have high barriers to entry and have been supported because they have high barriers to entry, because that's where we're going to get the medals. Mm. Ultimately, we are favouring sports which are sports that are for the wealthier people in our society, which is contrary to what we ought to be doing in terms of opening up sport to everyone in our society, no matter of how wealthy they are.
I see your point, and I agree to an extent. And cycling, once you get past a certain level, it's not necessarily cheap to, particularly for kids. You know, if you're growing quickly and you need a bigger bike every year or
First of all, you've got to your family's got to have a car to take you to races, because the races are miles away.
Well, yeah, I take the point there. I mean, in the example of the trot, I mean, if you've ever been to Welling Track, you know, it's a fantastic facility. But it's not a state-of-the-art place, you know. It's a concrete bowl as part of a wider sports centre and athletics track and all the rest of it. And they've got cages and cages of bikes that kids could turn up at the next event, the next training day, the next whenever they have an open day. Kids could turn up with no equipment and pay a relatively small amount of money to have a go at track racing. So you don't need to invest in a bike first and then find out if you like it. You know, there are very cost-effective bikes that you can start on. But in terms of, yeah, if you don't live within the catchment area of, say, Welling Track or any of the other facilities that there are, I quite agree that it's not necessarily the easiest sport to get involved in, unless you kind of get involved in the club structure, which, you know, was the traditional way of people getting involved in cycling, was to go to their cycling club and kind of learn about what it, you know, the way to ride in a group and sort of learn from older people who've cycled all their life, you know, how to be safe on the road. And I would certainly encourage that aspect of, you know, certainly one facet of people's participation is to ride with people who've been doing it a while, and that way, you know, you can add to your skills And that doesn't necessarily have to cost a fortune to be part of a cycling club. What do you really need? You need a bike, perhaps a pair of shoes, helmet optional, some padded shorts, really. That's not an extraordinary outlay in order to get involved in, you know, a fantastic sport that can literally take you anywhere.
Well, it's about £800, which is
yeah,
fair amount.
Well, it is, but well, what I mean, I haven't got it.
You've got three children. That's £800 times three.
Well, yeah, that's true. But how much is I suppose, yeah, when you compare it to a PlayStation or you know, three iPhones, yeah, it's a. But look at the lifelong benefit that people can have from getting a good start in a sport that keeps them hopefully fit for life. I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer. And unfortunately, you know, everything in this country is boiled down to the pounds and pence cost rather than weighed up against what the longer-term benefits are. I would argue that for an outlay of £800, if that's what it is, over the course of somebody's lifetime, that's a pretty decent investment to make.
It's a very decent investment to make, and if the government were in the business of handing out bikes to kids, I'd be very much in favour of that. I mean, I am playing a little bit devil's advocate here, and I'm testing the hypothesis that our funding of elite-level sport has chosen medals as an end in themselves rather than as a means to a greater end.
Well, yes, because I think that's, first of all, we're obsessed with things that are measurable in this country. The obsession with the medals table is bizarre, but understandable. They need to beat Beijing. They need to be the third best nation. You know, we accept that China and the USA are beyond reach, but we need to be better than, you know, France and Germany and South Korea. And there is certainly a bit of a flinch and a wince when anyone says, okay, well, let's cost this out. How much of Kazakhstan paid for their gold medals compared to Britain for their gold medals? And if we want to boil it all down to pounds and pence, then we may not like the answers. But Dave Brailsford gave an interview when he was asked what he thinks he will do next. And he answered that for him, it's more of the same. Try and win the Tour de France again. Look towards Rio. But then he said at the end that the next big target for him is increasing participation. And as the performance director of British Cycling and as the team principal of Team Sky, that isn't necessarily his remit to say that. But the fact he said it, I think, spoke volumes for what those two organisations are trying to do. And they are trying to get more people to embrace cycling, not just as a sport, but as a way of life. And I think that will maybe shatter the glass ceiling that you're talking about and make cycling more accessible to a greater number of people.
Because it's quite interesting, during the 20th century, cycling has gone from being a middle-class sport, or upper-middle-class, or upper-class sport in the 1890s, when the first, well, that was really the first safety bicycle boom happened, but it was certainly an upper-class sport in the 1870s when the first bikes came out, because they were costly things, and working people didn't have money and didn't have spare time to go and ride these things. During the course of the 20th century, as bicycles were mass-produced by companies like Rally, it was very easy to buy a bicycle. A bicycle would actually become something that was useful to you to get to work, and then you would race it at weekends. And it was a working-class sport, and there is still a certain amount of that at the upper levels in terms of age in cycling clubs that you detect. You know, that there is a different social stratum in a cycling club, the guys who are over 60, mm-hmm. compared to the guys who are coming in, or the girls, very few girls over 60, but the women who are coming in their 20s. Now it does seem to be much more of a middle class, maybe we're all middle class now and there's not much of a working class in our society, but it does seem to be a sport where it's quite metropolitan, it's quite oriented around spending money, style. The rafferization of cycling, you might want to call it. Sportives are now things that cost £60 to do a race rather than £4 to do a, or £2.50 to do a reliability trial or whatever a sportive used to be.
That's true, but the you know, that's personal choice. But you know, for every £60 or £30 sportive, it's worth pointing out that the roads are free to cycle on. You know, you don't have to pay money to participate in cycling. If all you need is a bike and ideally a friend or two to make it a more social experience. And I certainly, where I live at the end of the lane we're in, on a Saturday and Sunday, it's been excruciating to see the numbers of cyclists coming sweeping past while I've been busy with other things. I detect that a wider group of people are embracing cycling. They are getting into it, and I think that once it doesn't necessarily have to be. I go back to the point, you know, certain things are choices. You know, you don't have to spend £150 on a pair of shoes. You don't have to have the best sunglasses. You don't have to have the finest bike. You can get out and enjoy cycling in, you know, pretty much entry level equipment and an entry level bike, and you know, then progress through. I mean, for example, you know, take any sport. You know, if I played a bit of tennis in the past, but I didn't go and buy the same racket that Roger Federer plays with. I went and bought one that fitted the kind of the level for my, I'm going to play once a week. I don't want to spend, you know, £180. I want to spend sort of £30. So people are, I think, bright enough to tailor their expenditure and to not see that as a barrier to participation in something. I don't think it happens in other sports. I don't see why it should happen in cycling. Nobody, if you turned up at a cycling club's you know, Sunday club ride on a cheap second-hand bike, nobody is going to laugh at you and turn you away. There's not a problem with embracing, you know, if you want to look a certain way, ride a certain bike, if you're inspired to go and spend £6,000 on a Pinarello, fair enough, if that's what you want to do. But, you know, cycling is a broad church, and I think, you know, the doors are open to everyone.
Well, let's continue on our ride. We're going down this hill now, are we?
I realise I sound like the minister for cycling, but it's...
Your campaign starts here.
My campaign starts here, but, you know, why not? We're on the cusp of potentially the greatest sort of uptake in cycling that I've seen in my lifetime. People have watched it on the TV solidly for 4 weeks, really, the Tour de France and the Olympics. Cycling is on the front pages in one guise, but, we're not all Chris Hoy, we're not all Bradley Wiggins, but that doesn't mean we can't be who we are, you know, and enjoy cycling for what it is for us. And so, yeah, let's hit the road, back down the hill and into the flat lanes.
Oh, we're stopped by the road, and Lionel's just remarked that we're doing the very best thing to discourage cycling, which is to be seen to be fixing a puncture. I've had a puncture on my rear wheel, some new tyres. I'm not quite sure why they punctured, but they did. And having changed the tube once and then got another one in a different place, I'm now having to go back to the old school methods and actually patch this tube. This looks like cycling is no fun, doesn't it? My bike's here, it's upside down. We're standing here on the verge. It's kind of a slightly busy road, isn't it? So is this one of those sort of B roads that are actually quite nasty for cycling on?
Yeah, we went wrong. I missed a turning a little while back. I normally... I'm not the route planner. I follow my teammate, my clubmate. He sets all the agenda and steers me off into the countryside. I often don't know where I am or where I'm going or how far it is to get home. I missed a left-hand turn that would have taken us into the lane. So we've had to come along this road, which has given you a puncture. So it just seems always the way, really, with cycling. When you know, you've got to bear these things with good grace.
Well, it's true. It's all part of the rich pattern of cycling, fixing the puncture. Now, do you think that cement is tacky?
Yeah,
I think it is. I think we're going to go for that. I'll pass you the recorder.
It's time to... This is a radio first. They said snooker would never work on the radio, but puncture repair next to a busy B road.
There we go now.
I can tell you Jack is positioning the patch on the tube, pressing firmly but not too firmly, smoothing the...
You've got the backing sheet.
The backing sheet, yes.
There's a controversy about whether you remove the backing sheet, isn't there?
You certainly remove the backing sheet.
I think some people say you don't remove the backing sheet.
It wouldn't be a backing sheet if it weren't to be removed. That so that the little feathered edge of the patch sort of bonds.
Sometimes in the act of removing the backing sheet, you can also remove the patch.
Well, that's part of the it's a knockout nature of puncture repair.
Well, puncture repair is one of the events that would feature in the cycle touring omnium that I'm proposing for the inclusion in the next Olympic Games. It's one of eight events.
Shall I admit the cardinal sin of admitting that I throw away punctured tubes and replace with a new one in all circumstances?
You obviously don't do much cycling, because otherwise you'd have to be a very rich person to do that, or you've got very, very good puncture-resistant tyres.
I'm not going to comment on that, because that's the kiss of death, isn't it? But I do buy tubes in bulk when they're on special offer on the internet.
Well, I did put this question actually to bike show listeners and other folk on Twitter, and I said, "Is it you know, should I go beyond four patches on a tube?" And I got a very angry response with people saying, "You know, keep going until the patches are touching one another all the way around. Keep going, keep patching, patch away." Which, you know, I guess there's no reason why you shouldn't.
I'm quite willing to admit that I'm wasting resources and money. But
adding to landfill.
Well, they're actually in a bin liner in the garage, my punctured tubes.
Your own little landfill site in the garage. Okay, let's get this little nut onto the inner tube. And some pumping. All right, here we go.
This is live action tyre pumping. We've been here about an hour and three quarters.
What are you talking about?
No, we've been here about 5 minutes so far.
It's very good. I think this will put me in a good position in the cycle touring omnium. Oh, dear me.
What are the other events in the cycle touring omnium? Arriving at a B&B after 11 p.m.
No, it's a little tougher than that. Putting up your tent in the dark without a torch. That's one of the events. On the more pleasurable side, consuming a four-course French lunch with half a bottle of wine and compulsory île flottante, then cycling a further 100 kilometres before nightfall. Fording a stream, crossing a stile, and traversing a field occupied by a bull without being gored.
Right.
It's another one. Yeah, no, it's going to be a great sport.
And this will
work as a spectator as well. I just don't like the idea of Pat McQuaid getting his oar in the design of the Doors Galaxy, because I think that would be a step backwards in terms of cycle design.
I think this is an aspect of cycling that should evade the clutches of the UCI and have its own governing body, the Cycle Touring Olympics. I can see it happening in Rio.
Well, they've got some hills in Rio. It's just like Yorkshire, but sunnier, and the people aren't as grumpy.
Yeah. Woolen cycling jerseys in a hot Rio summer.
Yeah, well, the Cycle Touring Olympiad, there will be a strict prohibition on Lycra and any other performance-enhancing clothing materials. In keeping with the Corinthian spirit and the tradition of fair play.
You have to say the British are going to be hot favourites for the medals.
Well, yeah, you may say that, but actually I think the Dutch will be in there, the Germans. You know, when you're travelling around Europe, you find a lot of Dutch and Germans cycle touring. But the British have a particular sort of withered, gnarly toughness that, you know, would make them probably the people to beat, particularly in the veteran age group category. All right.
So, we're ready to get rolling again and get off this busiest road and get back into the lanes and hope for better luck.
Yeah, let's hope so. All right. Well, we've ridden up Ivanhoe Beacon, and it's quite a nice climb. It's kind of it's testing, isn't it? Because it's got that long drag at the beginning, and then you turn right and go over the cattle grid. Then it's got a sort of steep bit where then when I entered the woods, I thought, oh dear, maybe I've overcooked this. And then you have this quite flat summit at the top where you have to just keep on going till you get to the cattle grid. It's a different sort of climb from the ones that I usually do down on the North Downs, which are kind of pretty brutal and straight up 10%, and then you're at the top.
Yeah, it's the Alpe d'Huez of Hertfordshire. I think everyone will agree that it's a nice climb, isn't it? It's just that, how long did it take? What is it, 10 minutes?
Really? That much? I don't know. I suppose it depends when so you start. If you start at the cattle grid, it's got to be less than that.
Oh, yeah. It? Yeah, but you've got to count the drag on the main road before you turn onto it.
Well, having ridden over the beacon, we then faced the perennial cyclists and cycle tourists dilemma, lunchtime dilemma, whether to push on to the appointed lunch stop and risk that they will have closed the kitchen, and leaving us drinking beer and having a packet of crisps, having ridden for half a day, or whether to have a bird in the hand rather than one in the bush. Is that right? You're the analogy king. And stop at an earlier place that wasn't the appointed stopping point. And that's what we've decided to do. And Lionel's got a pint of lemonade. I've got a pint of bitter shandy. And we're now contemplating the menu.
We are. It's getting on a bit, isn't it? Late for a lunch stop, but we did have a puncture, so that kind of put us off a bit, put us behind a bit, and I managed to go wrong on roads I've been riding on since I was 13. I managed to miss a...
It was the pressure of being on the bike show.
It was. I was so busy thinking two steps ahead, I took my eyes off the junction.
Well, part of the Cycle Sport magazine coverage of this year's Tour de France was a kind of gourmet section where, Lionel, you talked about various meals that you ate, and it became quite, is it what we would call a cult classic section of the coverage?
It did. It was more popular than some of the other stuff we were doing in terms of the number of people who were looking at it. It was a runaway success, but I think that's part of the Tour de France journey is the landscape changes every day, the hotels change every day. I mean, I suppose, again, sort of take for granted the fact that you're travelling around, seeing all these places, eating some very nice meals on occasion when we get lucky, but also partly the idea was to show that it isn't a three-week holiday in France, and that sometimes we're left with petrol station sandwiches for dinner. Fortunately, this year that didn't happen, but I think you can see from that blog that it's not cordon bleu all the way round, that's
well,
for sure.
I always think that, like, bicycle racing involves a lot of skill and tactics. It's the same kind of thing when you're sitting down in a restaurant or cafe to eat. You have to place your order within the capacity of the kitchen to deliver something competent. If you're in a really down-home place, you shouldn't order the extremely elaborate dish because they're probably going to mess it up. Mm. You should go for something. So you've got to kind of assess the competence of the kitchen and the establishment, and sometimes that means playing safe.
Definitely, yeah. You go local if you can, because they're likely to be better at that. Don't have seafood or fish, unless you're at least, once you're more than about an hour and a half inland, that's a risk that's not worth taking. And basically, stick to what it looks, stick to what the establishment is likely to be able to turn out well. So go for the specials, whatever they're actually pushing at you, because it's likely.
You don't think that might be what they've got to get rid of?
I don't know. I mean,
they've got to get shot of this, oh dear, we've got a job lot of cuisse de canard, and Lionel's coming in, let's give him two.
A job lot of duck legs is not that's what other, could there be a better quantity of duck legs than a job lot? I mean, any restaurant that's got a surplus of duck legs is likely to be serving some pretty decent food. I'm not worried about that. I don't know. I don't think they're trying to foist stuff on hungry English cycling journalists who are just desperate to eat anything.
So let's analyse this menu. I mean, you're used to analysing the race, and let's take those analytical skills and apply them to the menu. Here, what seems to be going on is they are promoting two main courses for $9.95. I assume that's the pair so you and I will be able to have our main courses for $9.95 together, with a starter or a pudding in addition to that for £2.50, or we go on to the regular menu. Where I mean, I'm a bit worried about this place because I was always told that you shouldn't eat anywhere where the menu is in more than three languages, or there are more dishes on the menu than diners in the restaurant.
It's not filled me with joy. This looks like
Brake Brothers, doesn't it?
It does a little bit. I don't want to be too disrespectful because it's a lovely setting. It's a perfectly nice place.
Really nice garden.
But nice pub garden, nicely kept. But it is the ABC of English pub menus, unfortunately. I think that was one of the things I noticed about France, is that France is starting to adopt this kind of catch-all approach to catering, and that I think that's pretty sad. I mean, there was a time not that long ago, within the last 10 years, where you could go around France and really eat very well, cheaply, and know that the food really would change as you went around the tour. Whereas it's much more generic, particularly in larger towns now. And I think that's what we've got here. We've got the menu that has the section for burgers, the section for things with chips, and then
Lamb shank.
Yeah.
The lamb shank is always there, and that comes in a sort of
gelatinous sauce.
Well, no, it comes in a plastic
shrink wrapped
sort of vacuum packed. I mean, I think a lot of this stuff comes in with a jus.
They don't serve it in the vacuum pack.
No, well, not unless you ask for it specially. You may have to pay extra.
We're being a little bit...
We are. What are you going to go for?
Well, I think you can't go wrong with ham, egg and chips, can you?
That is the cyclist's lunch par excellence, if I may say so.
So, two of those then.
Yeah. Well, what did you make of your £5 meal, gammon, egg and chips?
I thought it was very good value. The ham was a very nice piece of ham. The eggs were well cooked.
You had two eggs.
Two eggs. I mean, that's the holy grail of ham, egg and chips, isn't it? When you get two eggs, that's... I'm trying to think of some kind of analogy to... But I'm too full of ham,
egg
and
chips. A double hammy? No, sorry. I had a last-minute diversion. The barmaid said that our most popular meal is the fish and chips, and I went for that, and it was okay. But I was looking lustfully across at your gammon. It looked moist.
I'm glad you said that. I'm glad you said gammon there.
Where are we going?
We're heading back now to Redbourne, which is, if we've got time, we'll stop for a quick espresso at the hub. Cycling-specific cafe. It's got a Great Britain skin suit hanging in the window at the moment, and they've written "Well Done, Wigo" on the window. I imagine if they've been adding all the medalists, the window will just be covered in writing. But we'll see. We'll see when
we get there. Okay, so about
half an hour,
10 miles or 8 miles.
Yeah, about 8 miles.
Okay, let's put the hammer down. We've reached our journey's end, which is the Hub Coffee Bar and Cyclists Refuge, 22, is this the High Street?
High Street, yep.
Redbourne.
Yes.
And it's a very pleasant little spot to sit here out on a very wide pavement with some seats and a little table, watching the world go by as puffy white clouds drift over a brightening blue sky, and the all offset by this lovely red brick, which seems to be kind of typical of the architecture of the area, this red brick.
I think
it
is, yeah. It's I'd love to be able to tell you a bit more about that, but I think it's kind of a Hertfordshire village, really, and I think today has shown me that I'm perhaps a little blasé about some of the villages around here. I've just ridden through them for years and years and years and never really stopped to pay too much attention to it. But yeah, it's turned into quite a nice day. The sun is out, and I'm regretting wearing leg warmers, that's for sure.
Well, leg warmers in August, I mean, I know you're a cynic and a pessimist and you always see the glass half empty, Lionel, that you have a reputation for that, but you know, that is definitely borne out by the leg warmers on an August day.
Well, it was cold and drizzly and overcast when I set out this morning, so you know, I was prepared for the worst but hoping for the best, and I think that's it's worked out for me on that score, I think.
So the People's Grand Tour kicks off next week. What's the first day?
Saturday, August the 11th. So that's the first stage. It runs until Sunday, September the 2nd. 3 weeks. Ride as many days as you can. Visit www.peoplesgrandtour.com to find out a bit more about how it works and how you can get involved. But really, it's very, very simple. Just go out, ride your bike, make a note of how far you travel and how long it took you. Tot up the total at the end of the 3 weeks, and check out the website to see how you can send your results in and just be part of a slowly growing movement of grand tourists who are dotted here, there and everywhere.
How many people did you have on the last one?
Well, it's difficult to say. I think we had about 80 people who qualified for the general classification, but you have to ride on 10 days in order to be listed in the results, which is it's harder than it sounds, because you know, if you work or you know, and you don't commute by bike, even in the summer, getting out every day at the weekends, there's 4 weekends, so that's 8 of your days. If you manage to get out both days, so you've got to find another couple of rides somewhere. Anyone who manages to ride 10 days in a 3 week period is doing pretty well. So I think we've had hundreds of people sort of embracing the idea of. But perhaps not everybody has managed to...
Not everybody's made it to Paris.
They haven't all made it to Paris, but that's the challenge, to try and set yourself a benchmark in this People's Grand Tour, that next year when we kick off again in the spring, you've got a mark that you can aim to exceed.
And it's not just distinctly mediocre cyclists such as you and me who are doing this. You've got some stars, haven't you?
Well,
we've
had Marco Pinotti, the Italian professional, who I think was fifth in the Olympic time trial a couple of weeks ago. He's taking part in both of them this year, sent in his information for every day of the 3 week qualifying period,
and fantastic. That's really great.
He really is kind of the people's pro cyclist, because you know, he rides, you get the feeling he would ride his bike if he wasn't you know, a professional. He just loves cycling. He got in touch, volunteered to send in his information, and I think even sent a congratulatory email to the guy who topped the standings of the first one.
So he's brilliant.
Yeah, he's embraced
it. We also ought to give a mention to the bike show's very own Kieran Yates, who's going to be a tough guy to dislodge from his spot as the champion of the long rides. He seems to notch up the very long rides.
Well, he's obviously an Audax specialist, and I had to email him to double check that it wasn't a typing error on the distance he submitted for the last People's Grand Tour. It was 400 and something kilometres, which is a very, very good Audax distance, isn't it? That's one category that he seems to have sewn up, but he's not managed to complete 100% 23 days out of 23, and there are, you know, there's a couple of people who managed it last time, and I think there may be a few more this time, but that is dependent on the weather and a whole host of other factors. And I appreciate that August is not ideal for a lot of people if they're going on holiday, but because we weighed it up and we thought better to do it now when there's still a decent bit of daylight on midweek days than to delay until September. So we shall see how it goes.
Well, if you've heard about the People's Grand Tour via the bike show, then do make sure that you let Lionel know, and we can have a little bike show team maybe. Yeah. within the general classification for the team prize. And on that score, I'm just going to reach over to my saddlebag. I've pulled out of my saddlebag a little gift for Lionel Burney, who's been one of the best regular guests on the bike show. His very own bike show jersey. These are highly coveted because there aren't any more. You've pretty much got the last one.
Wow,
because they were all done on a pre-order basis.
Fantastic.
I've got you a large because that was all there was, and I hope you don't take that as
a
personal slight. But after all your eating that you've been doing on the Tour de France, then maybe large is the right size.
Terrific. I think you should do a reprint of these because they're terrific. I mean, it's got a kind of a classic retro 1970s vibe. It's a very attractive kind of camping equipment brown, I'd say, a kind of orangey brown that sort of
It's a highly technical fabric, I'll have you know. It's not really widely available. It's one of the best companies made in the fabric is made in Switzerland, and the shirt is made in Slovakia. I don't know why I'm saying this, because you know, there's no point in me trying to sell it because there are none left to sell. But if you did buy a bike show jersey, now you know that Lionel's got one too.
Well, next year, 2013, we hope to have our own People's Grand Tour jerseys. I'm working out a way to find a way that I can do them as cheaply as possible, so that basically people could buy them literally at the cost of the jersey. So we're looking into that at the moment. Probably have some kind of competition to see, if a budding jersey designers out there who understand the concept of the People's Grand Tour and embrace it. So probably launch that at some point in the next once we're underway with this People's Grand Tour.
Well, thanks Lionel for taking me on a ride around these Hertfordshire lanes. It's been a great pleasure for me.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to me too. Thank you.